It's a great pleasure to welcome to Best Ideas 2024 a returning MOI Global instructor, Glenn Surowick. Glenn founded GDS Investments in 2012. Before that, he was at Alcyon Capital Management for more than a decade. And prior to that, Glenn worked for Enron Corp as a derivatives structuring manager and for Commerce Bancorp, now TD Bank, as a real estate credit analyst. And I'm sure those of you listening who've been with the MOI Global community for at least a year will know that Glenn and I do this as a Q&A. To get his thoughts and perspective on the environment for value investing and some of the companies and ideas that he has been looking at or owning in the GDS portfolios. So Glenn, why don't we, first of all, welcome, and why don't we kick it off with some initial thoughts, you know, that you may have for us.
Thanks for having me, John. Let's just kind of take a step back and just kind of for new listeners and new members of the MOI community. You know, I run a concentrated, separately managed account business, and it's a firm that invests on behalf of individuals and families, high transparency, low turnover, focused portfolios using a value-based approach. Let's maybe take a step back, and because I think, you know, the last year is, you know, sort of interesting to look at kind of where we were sitting a year ago. And, you know, you probably sense a little bit of excitement in my voice. And, you know, we had talked about kind of where things looked in early 2023 and the impact that higher interest rates were having on certain equities. And I described the environment last year as, you know, being pretty attractive in that you didn't have to sacrifice valuation or quality. And, you know, it's rare that those two variables sync up so perfectly, but I felt, you know, last year, and I mentioned three stocks. One was Meta, one was Alphabet, the other was Amazon, and all of them have done quite well in 2023, and they were all very, very big positions. And as much as, you know, those conditions, obviously, you know, as we fast forward to today, obviously a lot of that is you know, not available. But it just, I think, speaks to the importance of when you do have that proverbial fat pitch, take advantage of it. Those conditions are, you know, I wouldn't say they're rare. It's not like once in every decade, but they are kind of once every couple of years where you really just hit the stars kind of aligned and you have a lot of really great companies, companies that you understand, companies that have entrenched positions, and they check all the different boxes that you look for. And they're all trading beyond 52-week lows. And so when you have that in front of you, act act in size. So, things have moved a little bit, and I know they've moved sort of in an uneven way. I think if you look at, you know, what's driven the performance over the last year, you know, a lot of it funnels up to a handful of companies, and that's obviously not lost on me. You know, some of the other indices have done well. I think last year, you know, the Dow was up, but not nearly as much as the S&P, which wasn't up as nearly as much as the NASDAQ. So I think with kind of in those, you know, it's clear to me that the environment today is probably gotten a little bit harder, and it's harder for me. I think that if, you know, my criteria is pretty high. So, I mean, I want to own, you know, somewhere between like 10, 15 different companies, and I'm really just I'm trying to kind of establish a fairly high bar in terms of what I want to own. And there's not a lot of those around, so I would say that if you're in the stock picking business today, things certainly aren't as easy as they were a year ago. And if you must invest because that's what you do, which obviously I don't need to and I don't advise, then I think you need to kind of accept either a lower rate of return, or you have to accept lower business quality, or perhaps gravitate toward things that might not be overly correlated to the market, like maybe a turnaround or things like that. But again, like there, all of those requires one to accept maybe a different set of risk than they would otherwise. But that's just the reality of kind of where we are right now. I mean, there are some names out there that sort of check some of the boxes, but I kind of felt like last year was sort of unique in that regard. And anyway, that it's.
Got it. So Glenn, maybe we could just to make it a little bit more concrete, companies like Google and Facebook have had pretty good year last year, I believe.
Yeah.
So can you just reflect on those mega caps that I know you talked about, and how do you see those going forward?
Well, okay. So of the three I mentioned, I still own two. And I obviously the quality piece of it is well understood. And I think that the market it can get somewhat short-sighted at times. And I think that when you have macro forces like interest rate changes, especially when you come across a very long cycle of artificially low rates, I think that that does create some volatility. I don't know that they're quite screaming buys today. I think they're great businesses, and I think that if you own them for a long period of time, then obviously like that greatness will kind of shine through in the rate of return. So you don't necessarily need to like bottom tick these great businesses. I think the key is you kind of own them for a long period of time, and if you're right about the underlying business and how they're managed and how they're allocating capital and all of those sort of company specific variables, then you'll do okay. But obviously in terms of like buying them at a valuation level that is at the bottom of where they have historically, like obviously we've moved from that, right? So in any given year you see a much wider range in terms of stock price change versus underlying business value. So to the extent that you're able to buy it when stock price value is much 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 lower than underlying business value, like that we're obviously on we're on the other side of that equation right now. So I'm not I'm not like adding them in size, but I'm not necessarily selling two of them because they have been positions I've owned for a long period of time at one level or another. And I just felt like last year was an opportunity to really just kind of take it to another level. But yeah, great businesses, probably priced somewhat as such today, more so than obviously a year ago. But at the same time, I think what something investors, especially value investors that are always price conscious, a lot of times you can kind of anchor on maybe that great price that you were able to get a year ago and it's not there. But I will just say that, if you can operate with a long-term horizon and it doesn't have to be January 2024, there's enough volatility in the market. And I suspect that there will be enough volatility this year, just given what's going on with interest rate expectations and an important election year. There's just enough that kind of happens in any given year. That if you're patient, eventually a lot of them, they might not trade at levels that they did last year, but they'll trade at something where it's acceptable to make a decent rate of return over a long period of time.
Makes sense. So, what are some pockets of the market or just areas where you are looking or maybe finding more compelling, like from a valuation standpoint, more compelling ideas, let's say?
Okay, well let me, in order to answer, and I don't I kind of suspected you were going to ask that, and I don't know that I have nothing real. So we every year we kind of have a conversation, and I kind of remind people, it's like, okay, well what's my framework? And I think it's important to maybe just kind of touch on that. To put any ideas into, some context. I mean, I've spent a lot of time really understanding, who I am emotionally and what types of investments allow me to, maximize or short circuit the result. And so, I think there's certain characteristics with each company that, what once you once it becomes a live position, and you're going to get hit with just a lot of different news and things like that. I think it's important to really just kind of remember, why am I in this company? And what is it, a company that, like, for example, I mean, I obviously debt is something I avoid both at the portfolio level and at the company level. It's like, okay, well, why? Because a lot of times companies that are in debt, it there's obvious reasons when interest rates are going up, and depending on how that debt's structured, but the it's sort of there's also secondary consequences too. It's like, okay, well, if there's times of stress, how much flexibility does a company that has a lot of leverage really have? And I don't necessarily want to be involved in a company that just doesn't have that strategic flexibility when opportunities are at their best. Obviously, investing alongside really good people, that's important. Honest, ethical, really skilled at capital allocation. A company culture that values patience and experimentation, long-term thinking. I mean, the more I can be aligned with kind of how I see things with a company that sees things, then I think it just makes the journey a lot more doable. It is a marriage in some ways. And we talked about businesses that have some advantage and things like that. I don't really want a situation where, shareholders are winning but customers are losing. Like, to me, it's got to be win-win. And obviously we've always talked about, in this conversation, about the price component. If you overpay for all that, then chances are you're not going to do well. But if you pay an appropriate price, then you will. So, but I don't know that there's a ton of those where every box is checked. I would say that the one like the one area, like, so from a turnaround standpoint, I would say, a household name that I've been kind of picking at, in light of the fact that they have a new old CEO and the fact that they have some outside shareholders that seem to be holding management accountable, And in light of the fact that I think there's brand equity that's been there for a long period of time, and I think that there's a good chance that it'll continue to be that way. But it's there is business risk. I mean, there's no question about it. And that would be Disney. But it's probably something that if you're looking to maybe understand a situation, and again, like it all comes down to what you're emotionally willing to do, and you know, turnarounds aren't for everybody. But I think there's good people that are running the company, and I also think that I think there's activists that you know certainly have a history of you know holding boards accountable for capital allocation. But I do think that you know inside the company, I do think that there's brand equity, and that's certainly important in any turnaround. So that would be kind of maybe one example of. You know, of a situation that might work in a year where valuations aren't great, the stock really hasn't done anything for 10 years. There seems to be quite a bit of uncertainty around the stock, but they need to execute. And so, you know, if you're up for turnaround business risk, then that would might be a situation that you want to get closer to.
So, just in terms of your investment process and how you would evaluate something like a Disney, I mean, you know, how do you think about the markets that they're in, the streaming business? Help us understand, you know, how you get comfortable with some of those items and maybe any interesting resources that you use as part of your process.
Well, I mean, I would look at it like I do everything else. I mean, obviously there's a huge amount of news flow. You know, obviously we all know the ratio of actual news to important news is incredibly high. So, I think what I've done is just kind of, you know, just, you know, you can look at Value Line, you can look at company presentations, you could just, you know, obviously it's been in the news recently. I think how I would start with a company like Disney is, and I don't know if it's quite as easy as like good business, bad business, but I do think there's uncertainty around the streaming business and the profitability of it. I think there's going to be quite a bit of consolidation on the streaming side. I would think that Disney Plus might be, you know, one of the two or three you know, remaining players, but the profitability side of the streaming business isn't a slam dunk. And but then you look at other businesses too. I mean, theme parks seems to have a quasi monopoly. Seems to have, you know, just quite a bit of pricing power. I think there's interesting things to do with the ESPN brand, whether they put that into Disney Plus or not, I don't really know. But they seem to be leveraging it into other avenues. They just struck an entertainment a deal with Penn Entertainment on the gambling side. I don't know that I it's not as in terms of getting comfortable, I think that there's more art than science, I think, when it comes to Disney. I mean, I think that so to me, you have assets that are incredibly relevant and you know have been for a long period of time. So that's a really good starting spot in terms of restructuring the company. You know, and I think that you've kind of gone through a period of capital misallocation. Bob Iger was there, you know, had done very, very well. And you know, he's back. There's a level of accountability. So I would say that the likelihood of a repeat of a you know capital misallocation seems to be very, very low. And I don't know that the challenges in some of these businesses is necessarily lost on both management board and outside shareholders. So it there is a little bit of there's a little bit of a leap. I mean, it's a very, very competitive space, streaming. And I don't really have a clear sense of where they are on that pricing power spectrum. My sense is that a lot of the streaming players, at least when we come back to the final two or three, I do think that they do have considerable pricing power, but I don't know how that industry will consolidate. And at the end of the day, I don't really have a clear sense of where Disney is going to be. I would think that because of their proprietary assets and things like that, then they would have to be, part of, they sort of have a quasi monopoly within a certain demographic. But it's not without business risk. There's no question about it. But I would argue that, again, this is my superficial, it's something I'm looking at, something I'm following, but the fact that it's a 10-year low probably suggests that a lot of what we're talking about might be already priced in. I mean, there's a lot. It's almost impossible to find companies that are, still at 10-year lows. So there's a lot of just kind of frustration and angst, and all of the risks that I'm talking about, I would probably argue are probably already in the price. But I'd have to do a deeper dive to determine that.
Switching gears a little bit, we had quite an eventful year in banking, particularly kind of regional and community banks. I know you've looked at the space, have probably owned banks, I believe, in the past. So what's your take on that? And are we going to see the US banking landscape consolidate even more? Could it move toward a European model where there's really not much in the way of community banking as such? What's your take on the future of US banks?
That's an interesting question, John. There's a lot to unpack there. So I would let me answer it this way. So, I think what it exposed is this idea that in today's world, nothing is quite permanent when it comes to money. And you can move money, and you can move money based on, real fears and perceived fears. But I think that what happened to, a lot of the banks earlier in 2023 is, they were sitting on large unrealized losses, and interest rates went higher, and obviously their securities got repriced as a result. And in some ways, they showed a snapshot, of being insolvent. And so, if you're a depositor and you obviously get wind of that, and you can just, click a button and move money from one bank to another, I think a lot of those factors that banks were able to compete on, before money became so mobile, like service and things like that, a lot of that just goes out the window. I mean, the bank I worked for and the bank that I've owned, just back years and years and years ago, Commerce Bank, I mean, they were, they weren't rate sensitive. And in terms of the customers that they were bringing in, it was more driven by service, but a lot of that service piece of it, I think, has gotten competed out. So I could see sort of the bigger get banks getting bigger, and which would put it similar. There is a lot of just kind of pressure and inertia to kind of keep community banks relevant in this country. So I don't know. There's a little bit of tug of war in that regard. I don't know that I don't know that we are at a place where I still think that we're overbanked, to be honest with you. I mean, just I can tell you from driving around, yeah, there's a lot of banks that have branches and very few people seem to be there. And I think that banks aren't immune to the same expense pressures that other companies are. And if office portfolios are down 20%, then to me, banks are part of that same movement too. It's like, okay, well, what's the right level of overhead to support our customers? I don't own any banks now. I would say in the past, the two that I've owned Bank of America, but it was under conditions that I felt comfortable with, mainly Berkshire's involvement, and having that patient and someone with the ability to put a hole in potential losses and things like that. And as a partner, that's obviously very, very valuable. And JP Morgan, I've owned in the past, and a lot of that is more driven by Jamie Dimon and feeling comfortable about the jockey. But I suspect that banks are in for a tough. I think that they're complex from a balance sheet standpoint, and I their main funding source isn't nearly as sticky as they think. And I think that a lot of banks like to brand themselves on relationships and service and things like that. But I do think that anything that's tied to interest rates have become more commoditized over time. And so I don't know that I want to be part of that.
Do you think insurance is heading in that direction as well of becoming more commoditized over time? Or do you think some insurance
I think certain
companies?
aspect. I mean, I would suspect that if you're insured and there's some sort of long-term policy with a long-term payoff, then I would probably think about the durability of the franchise a little bit more. It's interesting. We just changed insurance providers. There's a commodity nature. I mean, it's not. I would suspect that some of the stuff that Berkshire is doing is they might be the only game in town. But I think the fact that how they built GEICO and as the low cost producer probably suggests that they even suspect that there's a commoditization to it.
Makes sense. One large cap you've talked about in the past is GE. Do you have any updated thoughts on GE? It seems like it's come back somewhat from
I
the
wasn't going
tough.
to toot my own horn. I mean, I'm glad you brought that up just to make me look good, John. No, I so I don't own it, but I certainly did very, very well on it. And I'm kind of going back memory here, but I'd have to look at my notes to when I first bought it, and I suspect it was 2019. But I don't want to say it was similar to Disney, but I kind of felt that you had a lot of the same characteristics. Obviously, they operate in very, very different industries, but I definitely felt that Larry Culp coming on a CEO was a very, very big deal. I was a little bit familiar with him from his time at Danaher. But I, I felt like I got to know him a little bit more, and it kind of put things aside when he became CEO, and I really tried to understand exactly like what his vision was and why he went there, and I believed him. But it did take a while for the market to kind of figure all that out. But I think that what he saw was a business that really had, just some outstanding units, and it was a matter of, maybe simplifying the business. And the first thing he obviously did is created a balance sheet that was going to allow the turnaround time to finish. And I think when he still felt there was a disconnect between just underlying intrinsic value and stock value, he went out of his way to create a plan for separation, which just further highlighted that valuation disconnect. But he also they he was he sold biopharma business to Danaher, really wound down the finance piece of it to simplify things, and realized that, I think the energy side, the aviation side, were, there was crown jewels there, and it was a matter of, and then obviously GE Healthcare. I mean, there was businesses there that were, incredibly good businesses. They had great customers. They were massively profitable. And to his credit, I think he, reallocated resources toward those, and I think he reallocated resources away from a lot of those other businesses that got them into trouble. And I think he curtailed, M&A from a, at least from an acquiring standpoint. And I have to go back and look at my notes, but I remember, they seem to have doubled down on certain businesses, and I'm thinking of the French company Alstom, I think, precisely at the wrong time, and they overpaid, and it just kind of, really complicated all these things, because, you're buying a business that's like leveraged to coal, and I just a lot of things that kind of went wrong. But I do think that like he brought some sort of big boy leadership. And I think he was able to, which isn't, easy to do. I mean, you're coming off like decades and decades of leadership that is philosophically different. And my guess is to pivot employees and to get them to believe in your vision, I think is hard. And to obviously to deal with the fact that like you have shareholders that, they didn't really own it in the first place when you were there, to kind of gain their trust, I think kind of speaks to how exceptional of a CEO that Larry Culp is. And so, yeah, it's done well. I don't own it right now. There was a while there I certainly did well with it. Did very, very well last year. And when you add up the pieces, it was a lot higher than what I paid. But it kind of fell into that turnaround category where you sort of have an entry, and then when you things that you think are going to happen start happening, and then the market kind of picks up on that and then kind of prices it differently. Then you have an exit as well, and so that's what I did. But there are companies that I will continue to track, especially as the aviation business gets separated later this year.
Great. Thanks for that update. And Glenn, maybe as we finish up, one other big development over the past year, at least in the minds of investors and public kind of consciousness, has been AI. And I'm kind of wondering whether you think that's just one of those buzzwords, or whether it will actually have big ramifications on value creation across sectors, and whether it will actually affect where investors should put their money long term.
That's a great question, and I think I would tackle it. So yeah, I mean, obviously the easy answer is that AI is very important, and it will continue to be important. Almost like if we were having a conversation 20 years ago, and you're like, Glenn, what do you think about the internet? I mean, it. Yeah, it's going to it's probably going to be deflationary in terms of it'll allow a lot of companies and industries to work more efficiently, which I think is a good thing. I think it's also going to have to be harnessed in a way where we don't allow it to just there's harm with any new technologies, and I think just kind of bottling it in a way that just benefits society would be nice. I don't know that we've been very good at that from a technology standpoint, and I don't know, like social media kind of stands out as something that it's really it's powerful in so many different ways, but have we done a good job of also making sure that it's like positive and powerful, and not like toxic, and there's a lot of unintended consequences. But from an investment standpoint, I mean, certainly there's a lot of companies that that I'm in that I wouldn't say they're like, they're at ground zero. I mean, they're very, very involved in AI. It's not what they're all about. So, I mean, it's not like you're pure play. There's other things, but I would say they're more, using it to improve their business. And I think probably the next stage is that maybe industries that are maybe due for an upgrade in terms of technology will probably use it to make their industries more efficient. I don't know that I have any like big where it's like, I don't know that I'm like this big thematic investor. It's becomes too difficult to really gauge the supply side and kind of where things shake out and winners and losers. And I mean, we've talked about this not recently, but I remember in some of our earlier conversations, it's like, we could, if we had a crystal ball in like 1996 and he had all these like internet providers, nothing really turned out the way that any of us would have thought in 1996. I mean, like, Prodigy and AOL and AltaVista, and like you have all these companies that just basically like died. So, but there's companies that have certainly gotten a valuation lift because of AI. I don't know that I'm directly involved in any of those. I mean, I know that like Amazon has been involved in AI for a long time, and Google has certainly been involved. I think Wall Street has certainly taken AI to another level, this past year. But yeah, it'll be hugely important. I don't know that I have like a single name that I could say that if you want AI, you got to ride this, especially in a concentrated portfolio. But I do, it's sort of scary good in a lot of different ways. And I hope that when we talk in 2 or 3 years that we're not saying it's scary bad. I mean, I think that there's a lot of really smart people that are involved in it. It does a lot of really incredible things. But I hope that we don't take this phenomenal technology and, just start using it for other purposes. But yeah, it's listen, it's certainly a reason why a lot of these companies are up, and NVIDIA and things like that, people that have this perceived AI advantage. And but I want to be probably on the side of, companies that are using it, getting more efficient. And, obviously are defined not just by this single technology. To me, that this is another long line of new technologies that these companies have kind of been at the forefront. And I would rather invest in those businesses that I think kind of have that mentality of we're going to invest in a lot. We think it's going to pay off. We've kind of earned the right to do that. And, obviously, I'm sure that Amazon is using AI in every aspect of their business to become better at what they're doing and to channel those benefits directly to its customers and make sure that at the end of the day, what they're delivering value far exceeds what they're charging customers. And so that's kind of where I want to be in this whole AI equation.
Terrific. Thank you so much. That will do it for me. I would just encourage MOI Global members to feel free to reach out with any additional thoughts or questions. We're always happy to facilitate an introduction. Glenn, as always, thank you so much for taking the time to share your wisdom and insights with fellow MOI Global members.
My pleasure, John.
Goodbye for now.
Bye.